everyone. Welcome to Nuclear Matters at CIL, a series of podcasts brought to you by the Nuclear Law and Policy Team at the Center for International Law, or CIL. For more information on the center and this focus area, you may wish to listen to our introductory episode on Introduction to Nuclear Law and Policy, a new focus for CIL. Today's podcast is the third in a series of four episodes that will cover the fundamentals of the three S's, nuclear safety, security, and safeguards, and their interrelationships. I am Nivedita. Together with Denise Cheong, we will be continuing our conversation with our special guest, Dr. Charles Ferguson, on the fundamentals of nuclear security. Dr. Charles D. Ferguson is the director of the Nuclear and Radiation Studies Board in the Division on Earth and Life Studies at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine based in Washington, D.C. He served as the president of the Federation of American Scientists for several years and was a senior fellow for science and technology at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he specialized on nuclear issues. He is the author of Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know, and the co-author of The Four Phases of Nuclear Terrorism. Given his background, Dr. Ferguson's scientific perspective on this area will provide a technical base for legal and policy discussions that will follow as part of this podcast series. Dr. Charles Ferguson, welcome back to Nuclear Matters at CIL. Having gone through the fundamentals of nuclear safety at our previous podcast, we now turn to the remaining S of the three S's, namely nuclear security. What exactly do we mean by nuclear security?
Well, with nuclear security, we're trying to protect against people who want to attack or damage or even threaten a nuclear power plant or a nuclear facility. It could be, a plant that makes nuclear fuel. It could be a plant that stores nuclear waste. It doesn't have to be an actual nuclear reactor that makes electrical power. And it's a broad, set of threats that would have to be protected against, ranging from criminals, terrorists, disgruntled employees. There's the insider threat. And there's cases where you have people who are supportive of political movements, protesters, for example, who may not want to cause a lot of damage, but still want to draw attention to nuclear power and also the political power it represents. So nuclear power is a very potent symbol in a lot of countries, and people might want to target nuclear power plants or nuclear facilities because of the political power and the economic power behind that. And I also should mention that the other threat that a lot of people aren't aware of is the military threat. And if you would look at the area of the Middle East, since I would say the late 1970s, early 1980s, there have been several attacks against nuclear reactors in the Middle East, ranging from Israel bombing the Osirak reactor in Iraq try to prevent Iraq from acquiring materials that could be used in nuclear weapons. So that also kind of crosses into the safeguards area we'll talk about later. We have seen attacks during the Iran-Iraq war, where Iraq targeted the Bushehr nuclear power plant being built in Iran. And fortunately, no other areas of the world have seen military attacks against nuclear power plants and nuclear facilities. But it's interesting that India and Pakistan have a long-standing agreement to exchange the list of nuclear facilities, and they do that toward the beginning of each year. And these are facilities that are not supposed to be targeted. It's like kind of a detargeting list. So it's a way of having a confidence-building measure between those two nuclear-armed rivals in South Asia. So it's a very complex space, security. And the other real challenge with security is developing a security culture. When we talked about nuclear safety, I emphasized the role of safety culture and how that is instilled in nuclear power plant operators and the heads of the companies that run nuclear power plants from the top to the bottom to make sure that people are always questioning what could happen. Similarly, we need to have a security culture, but it's been very challenging because a lot of the people who get jobs as guards, frankly, tend to be kind of disgruntled people, or they're not paid very well, they're not being well respected. At least that had been the traditional practice. And I think in light of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and other incidents, there's an effort worldwide to improve the professionalism of security forces at nuclear facilities.
Thank you very much. Now, would you classify nuclear security as including, as you mentioned, the potential modes of attack or sabotage? What are these modes? And what do you think has been done so far to protect against these attacks?
There are multiple modes of attack or sabotage that can be used against a nuclear facility. I'm using the word nuclear facility to include nuclear power plants and reprocessing facilities, nuclear waste sites, a whole suite of different types of facilities that involve nuclear activities. So, for example, there could be more of a traditional commando-style attack. You could imagine, armed terrorists with automatic weapons and armored SUVs or any kind of armored personnel carrier, just charging against a nuclear facility and trying to break through the gates, guns blazing, trying to shoot the place up. That's, I think, kind of the image in a lot of people's minds. Probably not the most likely mode of attack because it's pretty obvious. it's maybe not going to be very successful because there are layers of protection at a nuclear facility. There are security guards, and the training of the guards has been improving over the years. There are layers of fences. To get to the actual reactor itself requires breaching, several layers of defenses. So I think that's pretty well protected. So another mode of attack could be cyber attack. And this is something that traditionally has not been a big concern at nuclear power plants in particular, because most of these nuclear power plants are what are called Generation 2 plants. They're fairly old designs. These are designs that were kind of developed and built in the 1960s, 1970s, and even in the 1980s. And it was mostly an analog type of world with the gauges and meters of nuclear power plants and the instrument and control systems were not really digital or sometimes not digital at all. And so that's kind of good and bad. It's good in terms of not being vulnerable against a cyber attack that could target digital control systems. But it's bad because maybe it doesn't give you the type of control that an operator would need in operating a modern nuclear power plant. So there's been an effort over the last couple of decades to move toward more digital control systems and to have connections to the internet. And so here's where there are potential vulnerabilities for cyber attacks. So one method of protecting against that would be to have an air gap to make sure that the critical control systems, the safety systems at a nuclear plant are disconnected from the internet. And another method is to make sure that operators can't just stick in a thumb drive into a control system at a nuclear power plant. But we saw that with the case with Iran several years ago, the issue of Stuxnet. So it was a computer virus that was on a thumb drive, and it was able to be introduced into the uranium enrichment facility at Natanz in Iran. And an operator, stuck the thumb drive into the control system and thinking that it was something that was allowed, that would be useful to for the operation of the centrifuge plant. But it turns out there was this computer virus hidden inside the thumb drive, and it caused havoc of the plant, and it destroyed hundreds of the centrifuges at the enrichment plant caused a lot of damage. And so that's one example of targeting a facility that some countries believe could have been used to make nuclear materials for nuclear weapons, or also make materials for commercial nuclear power in Iran. And so the cyber threat is constantly evolving. It's not something that's easy to protect against, especially as we're moving more toward digital control systems at nuclear facilities. Another attack mode could be, crashing an airplane on a nuclear facility. And so we saw examples of, airplanes used to deadly effect in the September 11th, 2001, in my country, United States, in New York and Washington, D.C., where we had four terrorist cells that targeted individual sites, the World Trade Center tower and towers and the Pentagon in Washington. And prior to that event, one of the lead terrorist leaders, Mohammed Atta, was reported to have done surveillance of a nuclear power plant in New York State. And he was the airline passenger. He took photos. He looked at the facility from up above. And he reported back to Al-Qaeda leadership that, in his view, it was too well protected, that it was very likely they would not be able to cause a lot of damage by crashing an airplane into that nuclear power plant. So that's an example where there was a terrorist group that reportedly was looking at that mode of attack, but backed away from it because it just looked like the chances of success were very low. And there are variants on some of these attack modes that I was just mentioning. Going back to the commando attack, could be, instead of just charging with guns blazing right up front in the nuclear power plant, you can imagine more of a sneak attack or attacks by waterborne routes, because nuclear power plants all need water cooling to maintain the safety of the plant. So that's a potential vulnerable point that needs to be protected and make sure that lakes and rivers and oceans where the plants might be next to have adequate protection. So those are just some major examples of attack modes, and it's a constantly evolving threat space. And I think the main tool that's used to try to guard against that is what's called the design basis threat, or DBT, and this is a well-known method that's developed internationally, and a lot of national authorities with nuclear facilities, they follow the DBT, or design basis threat, process to first identify what are the potential threats based on intelligence assessments, and then what types of protection is needed to guard against those potential threats, and then what types of training is needed to make sure that the guards are ready, for example. And so it's a very thorough process. It's becoming a more professional process. And I think by and large, that's very good news for the security of nuclear plants.
Thank you very much. So this sounds like the design basis threat assessment that you mentioned is quite similar to the layers of protection that you were talking about in relation to nuclear safety, otherwise known as defense in depth, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly right. So I think defense in depth is a really key concept across the board for nuclear power. And it's different methods, different kind of layers to get defense in depth, whether it's guarding against an accident in terms of safety or guarding against an attack from a military unit or a terrorist unit, for example. But the general concept is really the same, making sure that there's more than one layer of independent protection. And I emphasize the word independent because you want to guard against kind of a common failure mode. This is the so-called Swiss cheese model of protection, where with Swiss cheese, you have these pockets and holes throughout the block of cheese. So imagine that you have some kind of like a rod or something, you're trying to stick it through a hole in the cheese. You want to make sure There's not any pathway where that rod can go entirely through the block of cheese. So, and to make sure that all the holes have some kind of coverage. So, and a part of that concept relies on the fact that not any single layer of protection is perfect. And so there's going to be some likelihood of being able to penetrate or defeat that layer of protection. But if you can put in place, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 different layers and line it up so that there isn't a hole, so to speak, that you can then penetrate the defenses, either from a security standpoint or from a safety standpoint, where you make sure that you have layers such as, you know, the fuel cladding to prevent the fuel from escaping, the fission products from escaping. Then you have the cooling water systems, and you have layers to make sure you have emergency cooling systems in place. You have multiple means of electrical power that can be provided to power pumps to make sure that water can be directed to the core of the reactor to keep that reactor cool. And then you have on top of the reactor itself, the containment structure to contain the pressure buildup that could happen during an accident, to make sure that the radioactive materials that could be released in an accident are contained inside a heavy concrete structure that's often have, you know, it's steel reinforced, and it tends to be very rigid and strong.
Thank you very much.
Charles, in our discussions on nuclear safety, you mentioned that safety is really about preventing accidents at nuclear facilities. And if accidents happen, it's about mitigating harm to people, to the environment. Thinking back to that discussion, and in light of what you've just shared on nuclear security, what would you say are the key differences between safety and security?
Yeah, that's a very important question. It's something a lot of experts are still struggling with, to be honest. And there are situations where you know, safety and security might work at cross purposes. So, for example, if someone sees a radiation hazard sign that is warning someone behind that closed door is a highly radioactive material, that serves a safety purpose. That's warning people, stay away or be careful, take adequate protection. You could risk exposing yourself to high levels of radiation. However, imagine there's someone who has a malicious intent, someone who's a criminal or a terrorist, for example, who wants to acquire that highly radioactive material to then create a so-called dirty bomb with it or some kind of radiological weapon. So that radiation safety sign serves as kind of a beacon saying, here it is, here's the material, go right behind that door and you could try to grab it. So that's a case where safety could unintentionally lead to reduced security. Another way that security could be reduced could be in a situation where you have a guard force around a nuclear power plant, and the threats are against the nuclear power plant have gone up. So the owner of the nuclear power plant says, aha, I need to hire more guards. I need to you know, make sure that we have guards everywhere. So instead of, you know, 10 guards, what we typically have, I might need to have 30. And so a unintentional adverse consequence of that could be that with more guards, there's what's called social shirking. So each individual guard may say to herself or himself, well, you know, I don't have to work as hard because, you know, Susan over there is really diligent and she's a great guard. And I can go and you know, maybe even go take a nap, you know, or go watch, you know, something on my smartphone. I don't have to pay attention as much because I can rely on her. But little does, you know, Frank, you know, for example, that guy knows that, well, Susan might be thinking the same thing about him. So, you know, there are examples where just having more guards doesn't lead to more security. And also we have this now heightened situation in the world where, because of events like the 9/11 terrorist attacks, there's more responsibility placed on the owners and the operators of nuclear facilities or facilities that have these highly radioactive materials. So not only does someone have to be trained in safety, he or she also has to be trained in security. So it's, you know, it's additional, maybe additional pressure, additional responsibility, additional training. And so there again, it might result in the reduction of safety or security because we're asking our workforce perhaps to do too much. But I think every person who works in a nuclear plant needs to have some general awareness of security and also has to feel that, you know, they have that responsibility. If they see something that might be wrong or something that could be a potential threat, they need to speak up and they need to be able to do it without retribution. There has to be protection of whistleblowers. There has to be protection of employees who say, you know, I think there's a potential problem over here. The first reaction shouldn't be to punish that person. It should be to say, hey, we're listening. What do you think is going on? Let's work this together as a team. So it's a very complex set of issues, safety and security. And we're asking our workforces at the nuclear facilities to do a lot because it is a very special job. Nuclear is special. It, you know, to quote a lot of colleagues of mine, it's, you know, nuclear power is not just a means of boiling water. You know, you could do that with coal or natural gas or, you know, other types of forms of energy or sources of energy. You know, nuclear power, as we've been talking in this podcast, has, you know, the concerns of the nuclear waste and the highly radioactive materials. And we have to ensure that, you know, there are adequate protections, whether it's due to a threat from safety or a threat from a security issue.
That's a very interesting point, Charles, that I hadn't thought about. Are we asking, as you say, the owners and the operators to do too much, you know, to worry not just about safety, but also security? We can understand why they need to take on board both concerns. But when we think about the people on the ground, the workers in the plant, for example, and just to pick up on your earlier point about safety culture and then about security culture, typically, are they different groups of people, Charles, that have responsibility for safety and security culture? Or is there an expectation that increasingly people need to get on top of both cultures? And to me, they seem in some ways quite different.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think primarily we're talking about two different groups of people who have that those responsibilities for safety and security. You know, primarily for safety, we're talking about the people who are operating a nuclear power plant. People are in a control room who can move valves remotely or can move the control rods of the nuclear reactor. And we're also talking about people who have to go around and look at the nuclear power plant and ask themselves, is there some funny sound over here? Is there something leaking over there? And so that's really more of a safety issue. And then we have a group of people, the guards primarily, who don't have that safety responsibility per se. It's not part of their job description to be asking those types of questions. They really have to stay focused on, you know, protecting against attacks against the nuclear facility. But there should be also a general awareness among both groups that about safety and security, and that how they're interrelated, as we've been talking about these interrelations. So, you know, one key concern at almost any facility, especially a nuclear facility, is what's called the insider threat, that there is could be an employee who could be disgruntled, could be blackmailed by a terrorist group or a criminal group, could be feeling some kind of financial pressure, number of different reasons why a particular employee may cross a line and decide to help out a terrorist group or a criminal group to be able to damage a nuclear plant or gain entrance to a nuclear plant. And so that's a case where it's, you know, typically an employee who would have more of a safety responsibility, who understands how the safety systems operates, understands the operations of the nuclear plant itself, and who could then pose a security vulnerability. So, you know, I think that's a main example where, you know, those two fields of safety and security really, really intersect in a bad way.
This brings us to the end of today's discussion on the fundamentals of nuclear security. Thank you for listening to episode 3 of Nuclear Matters at CIL. Do look out for episode 4, where we will continue our conversation with Dr. Charles Ferguson on the fundamentals of nuclear safeguards. Have a good day.